Good evening.
Allow me to welcome you to a program that is really going to change your year. This is going to be an incredible journey that you're beginning to undertake. As we go through, as we study the whole of Tanakh during this year. So let me first applaud you for taking the step to be here tonight, because it's monumental in your own lives of making a commitment, because it is a commitment throughout the year. But I can tell you, from the people who took this course last year, you're going to be very happy that you did so. It's really going to enrich your knowledge, enrich your life, enrich your sense of spirituality and meaning in your life by taking this course. This course is really something that we're really so proud of here at the synagogue. I'll just give you a little bit of a background to the course. First of all, my name is Shalom Morris. I'm assistant rabbi here and director of the course. So throughout the course of the year, after this class, you have any questions, anything you want to talk about, you just want to come and say hello, my door is open, and I'm more than happy, and I look forward to speaking with you and to getting to know each of you during the course of the year. The history, a little bit of the background to the course, is that 2 years ago we were, is when I started working here, and we had a year of programming, and we had a lot of different classes going on, and each class had 10, 15 people, and when we got 15 people at a class, there was a sense of euphoria. We had 15 people in a class, that's great, what a success. And then it hit me, when you have 600 families in your shul, 15 people in a class, really, that really isn't the greatest showing in the world. And so I started thinking and asking and talking to different rabbis and other communities, and I found that was what most, that was the experience that most communities had with attendance for their classes. And so we started thinking, and we're wondering, is it that perhaps people just really aren't interested, that learning is not for everyone, or perhaps they just weren't happy with what was being offered. And we decided that probably was B. People have very busy lives. Each of you have very busy lives. Many of you are coming from work. You have other programs that you're participating in. It's a lot of running around. And you're happy to learn, but it really has to be worth your time. And we decided we needed to present something to people that would be worth your time, that you would feel, this is worth it. If I'm going to spend an hour and a half learning a week, if I'm going to run from work, it has to be something that I'm really going to get something out of. And we looked around at a lot of different programs, and we finally came across the Tanakh course, which was developed in an institute in London called the London School of Jewish Studies, which is a Jewish adult education institute in England. And this is a course that they developed. They developed it together with Rabbi Menachem Liebtag, who is a well-known Bible educator in Israel, in Gush Etzion. And they spent a lot of time in developing and researching the subject, and ultimately put together the program that we're going to be presenting to you during the course of the year. And what we found from last year is that it was true, that it worked, that if you spend a lot of time, you put a lot of effort into what you present to your community, that people are appreciative and people do come out. There were over 100 people take the class last year, and we decided, you know what, let's give it another shot this year and see how it goes. And you can look around, and it's great to see each of you here. In addition to that, we're also offering a new course that we're developing in-house this year, our Sfarim Bashana, where we're going through, after the times of the Bible, of the most influential Jewish books written after the time of Tanakh, starting with the Mishnah, the Medrash, the Talmud, coming all the way down to contemporary times, looking at the works of Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rav Kook, and everything in between. And that's going to be a great course. We've got a lot of great presenters coming for that as well. But in my mind, that's maybe the second step. Really, you're doing the core. You're doing the basis of our religion, the source of Judaism. And I applaud you for doing it. And you're really going to be so satisfied that you signed up, that you took this course. And our hope, our ultimate hope, is that what we're doing here is going to change the way that education takes place across the country. That the way education will take place will be thoughtful. That just like we try to do curriculum development and really think through what we do for educating our children, and perhaps high school and even college level, that there's no reason that shouldn't be taking place on an adult level as well, and a synagogue level as well. And that it's really the mission of a synagogue, the mission of a community, to make sure that we educate our adults as well. And what's one of the beautiful things about this course and other courses that we're developing is that it's going to be meaningful for you regardless of your background. If you can't read Hebrew, you're going to get a lot out of this. If you studied in yeshiva through high school, through post-high school, you're going to get a lot out of this course. It's very well developed, and everyone's going to gain a great deal from it. And you're welcome to ask questions throughout. Everything's going to be translated in Hebrew, English, and so on. But it's going to be a great experience, and I'm really so excited that each of you are here tonight. I'm just, for my own curiosity, how many people heard about the course because of this flyer in the Jewish Week? Just by, if everyone could raise their hands high, just so I can see. Okay, great. Thank you very much. Okay, just help with what works and what doesn't. Okay, great. So before we really begin the course, I just need to do a little bit of housekeeping, just to get everybody up to date with a couple of important things to be aware of throughout the course. First of all, registration. Just as you did tonight, coming early to make sure to sign in, each week we're going to be taking registration, checking in to see exactly who's here. It's a way of us to manage attendance and so on, to sort of see if anyone needs added encouragement throughout the year. And so it ultimately helps our record, so everyone needs to come early for that. In addition, each week, just as you receive tonight, handouts, you're going to be receiving handouts each week. A class outline and various charts and so on. So come early to get that so you can get a seat, because we do hope to start promptly in the weeks forward. Really at 7 o'clock we're going to get started so that we can finish on time and everyone can get on to wherever you're going next. We'll ask that during the course to keep your cell phones off so that everyone can fully appreciate the class. Now just a couple of things. It's going to be hard to make it each week. Last year out of 110 people, two people made it throughout the whole course without missing one. So chances are one of you will make it throughout the year, and the rest of you will have to miss because of family celebrations or a vacation or a holiday or whatever the case may be, and that's expected. We assume that you'll have to miss from time to time. One of the things that we're going to be doing is recording each of the classes and making CDs for you that you can just pop into your computer and you can make up the class. We'll give you all the handouts. Those will be available in the shul office by the end of the week of when the class was given, but certainly on the following week when you come for the class, we'll give a packet to you with that information so you can make up anything that you missed. So if you miss the 1 week, don't get down and say, I missed 1 week. Forget it, because you didn't miss it. You're going to make it up on the CD, and you'll be able to continue the course that way as well. One of the things we also did, each of you as you came in was handed a card with your name on it. Now the reason for that is that in addition to this being a course where you're going to learn a great deal, we set up the room specifically in a way that everyone's sort of facing each other. Because in addition to learning from me, I'm hoping that you'll each have an opportunity to learn from each other and to get to know each other, to build relationships, to make friends. Last year, made great friends. Coming in week in, week out, getting to know people that they hadn't met before either. They've been coming to the same synagogue for 20 years, but in the large congregation, you just sort of miss each other. Or people are coming from other places, and it's a great way to make new friends. So I'm going to ask that each week you bring your card with you, put it by your seat, and that way, hopefully over the course of the next few weeks, next month and a half or so, everyone will start to get to know each other's names, which will be really nice, I think. One of the nice benefits of coming to a class like this. Let's continue. Preparation. Somebody asked about preparation for the course. There's no real preparation that you need to do. There's preparation if you want to do it. If you take the sheet that is handed out, so over here is a schedule of the course. Now, one of the things you're going to notice is that there's not a week off until March. So like I said, it's going to be a long haul, week in, week out, but we needed to really go straight through with the holidays coming so late. The course as it is isn't going to finish until mid-June. But if you notice, in the third column says preparation. So there's reading that you can do each week, if you like, in preparation for the class, reading a chapter or two. Now, there were those last year who decided to read the whole book each week. That's really hard. you're welcome to do it. But if you want to do at least a little bit of preparation, I would suggest reading those chapters. Just it'll give you a little bit of a sense about what the Sefer is before the class actually starts. And before we actually start learning about that class. Now, something else that I want to suggest, maybe we'll hand out a sign-in sheet for anybody that'd like to do so. What I'd like to do is that each week, if one person can volunteer, to write a one or two paragraph summary of the class. And then what we'll do is we'll write up that summary and email it to the group. So that way, that sort of way of reinforcing. It's something that came out from questions that we asked the group from the end of last year, was that you're going to have a lot of information coming through each week. If you had a chance 2-3 days later, or a week later, to read something, that just a quick recap of what the class was would help to really reinforce everything that you learned and help you to remember it that much easier. So I'm going to send around this schedule, and if each person could, no one has to, but if each person could maybe write their name next to one of the classes, that'll sort of be your class to stay awake. And make sure to maybe then email me the following week or the end of the week a little bit of a summary. My email, for any of you that don't have it, is Rabbi Morris, R-A-B-B-I, M-O-R-R-I-S, at lss.org. And you can get that from the Shul office. Rabbi Morris, Rabbi, and then last name Morris, M-O-R-R-I-S, at lss, Lincoln Square Synagogue, .org. Okay, so I'm just going to sort of... take this and pass it around, and everyone can just sort of take. And everyone, if you want, again, no one has to. It's not a big deal. I'll just write a paragraph or so for the class. Okay. Great. Okay. Another important announcement before we start is that the one required piece of material that you need to bring each week, in addition to your binders, if you like, is a Tanakh, is a Bible. We're going to be studying, and one of the nice things about this course is it's not just a lecture, it's going to be an opportunity for you to study as well, for you to actually open up, to read inside, and many times the teachers, as you see in your schedules, there's a variety of teachers, each teacher has their own style. Many of the teachers will be going around, asking people to read, will be reading from here, but it helps to have a Tanakh to look in inside. So everyone needs to bring a Tanakh each week. So what I want to do is just take a few minutes to introduce you to some of the editions that are published of Tanakh, or all Tanakh, they all have the same words and size, but different publications, different translations that are available. That's just Chumash. That doesn't mean the five books of Moses. So that's not going to last so long. And the truth is, even sometimes in certain weeks, while you're studying a particular book, the teacher may make reference to another book. And so it'll be helpful to have the whole Tanakh with you. So I'm going to start with perhaps the most common. This one is actually in Hebrew, but it's published with Hebrew and English, typically known as the Jerusalem Bible. That's the traditional one that many people have. It's an excellent translation, but it's an archaic translation, a lot of thous and arts and things like that. So it's a good translation, but it's a little bit old. But it's a nice Tanakh. If you like, the printing of the Hebrew is very beautiful. And that comes both in a bigger size and also in a smaller size like this. In addition, an excellent Tanakh is what's called the JPS Tanakh. This is a really excellent translation. It's a little bit difficult the way it's laid out to do the reading, but it's a very modern translation. And it's a great, it's a very nice Tanakh. I think it also comes in a large and small size. All of these Tanakhs are somewhat expensive. I believe this is probably the most expensive of the edition. The most work went into its production, but that's a good version as well. And the final edition, this is one that some of you may have already. Needs to be a weightlifter to pick it up. That's the Art Scroll publication of Tanakh. It also comes in a small size. And this publication is interesting. The translation isn't precise within the Art Scroll publication. They translate it more according to different commentaries, ways of translation. It's not a literal translation so much of the actual text. So if you want a literal translation, this isn't the version that you want. However, it is laid out beautifully. In addition, it has on the side of the page little summaries of what's going on in each paragraph. So that's very helpful. Way of if you open up your Tanakh and you quickly want to see what something is talking about, it is nice to have those summaries and little comments on the bottom. So it is a good version to get as well. I believe all these are probably on stock at Westside at Judaica. It'd be easy for you to pick it up. You can get two versions if you really try hard. But one thing that will be interesting is some of the teachers during the class, they may read from the Hebrew and then they're going to translate on their own. They'll just sort of read a translation, and it may be the translation that's found in one version or in another version, and so on. So don't worry, whatever version you have is just fine. But that's one of the nice things that we'll be doing is the teacher hopefully will help really bring out what the translation of the word is as a way of understanding what the text is actually saying. But regardless of what edition you have, bring an edition because they are going to be really helpful and necessary for the course. Okay. Great. It's great to have you here. That's the prelude to the class. Welcome to the class. You're about to begin a wonderful journey throughout our tradition, throughout our biblical tradition, throughout the source of everything, through the source of Judaism. One of the ways that Jews are referred to is as the people of the book, right? So this is the book that they're referring to, right? This is the book they're referring to. It's not, in fact, a Jewish term for Jews. Does anyone know where that term comes from, people of the book? It comes from the Quran. It comes from the Quran that their Jews are referred to. It's an Islamic name for the Jewish people, that we are known as people of the book. It's something that we're proud of. Yeah, we're people, I don't know, some might say we're not people of the book. But in any case, certainly that is something that we do hold dear, that is who we are. Yet I would guess that many of the people in this room have not studied the entirety of Tanakh. And so that's probably why each of you are here tonight, because this is going to be an opportunity for you to be introduced to the source of our tradition. So welcome to the class. If you open up your sources, and just there are three handouts. I just want to make sure everyone has one. The first handout is the schedule that I passed around. The second handout is a picture, and then the last group of handouts are a bunch of sources. So before we begin, this picture, you can tell that this course was developed in England by some of the sources that we're going to find. All the handouts, for the most part, are the handouts that were created in England. You can see they're very beautifully put together. If there are any extra seats, there are extra seats up here on the side. Welcome to sort of pass through this space. Okay. This painting, it's found in Westminster, the Palace of Westminster, and it says the English people's reading of Wycliffe's Bible. Now, it was painted in 1927. Anyone know who Wycliffe was? He translated, right. He lived in England in the 14th century, and he did something that he wasn't supposed to do. He translated the Bible from Latin into English. And that was something that was not so popular among the authorities. In fact, it was something that was illegal. And in 1401, the Heresy Act was proclaimed in England that said that anyone who, in fact, reads a Bible that's not a priest will be put to death. So what do you think? And so in this painting, what they're showing is Westminster sitting there reading the Bible to the people. As you can see, they're sort of out in the middle of nowhere, down the edge of a forest. There's a couple of men standing around, guards, sort of looking to make sure no authorities are on their way, and the rest of the people are having a chance to study the Bible from a person who is not a priest. Now, why do you think they would have... Now, this is in Catholic England, right? This is before the Protestant Reformation. Why do you think they made it illegal for people to study the Bible? Yeah. Why should, so what's wrong with that? Okay, right. One possibility is that maybe people will be challenged by what's written in the Bible, and maybe it will lead them to heresy. Right, that's one possibility. What's another possibility? Yeah?
It might challenge the formal church.
Right. They may say, oh, I don't think that's what the Bible says, and it's a way for the church to go ahead and say, no, this is what the Bible says. And you can't argue on me because you can't read it, right? You have no way to read what it says. It's written in Latin. Only the priest knew how to read Latin. Any other suggestions? Right. I think those are some of the important reasons for why that would have been. What I think is special, and it's why you're here tonight, is that that's never been part of the Jewish tradition. Right? We have always encouraged people to expand their Jewish literacy. Right? That's something which is so much at the heart of the Jewish people, right? All people of the book, is that Jewish learning, the learning of our text, is paramount to who we are. And it's not just the rabbis, it's not just the scholars, but everyone. every Jewish person is supposed to be a literate Jewish individual. And that's really what this class is about. It's a way of enabling, it's not gimmick at all, but it's a way of really enabling each of you to become literate within Tanakh, and hopefully even through the course of the year, to be inspired perhaps to study even more so, to find out and say, hey, you know what? I never studied the book of Ezekiel, I never studied Yechezkel before, I never realized that's what it's about. That's an amazing book, and I want to study it more in depth. And it's a way of being introduced to all these books in a way which, in and of itself, will be satisfying, but will most likely also inspire you to do further study on your own, either during the course of the year or after the course is completed. Okay. Tanakh. Tanakh is probably, and I think you should make a case for this, the Tanakh is probably the most influential book in the history of the world. It is. Half of the world's people believe in Tanakh, believe in the Bible, and the ideas that it contains have influenced the world in an incredibly powerful way. If I were to ask you what the major contributions are of Tanakh, probably the first thing you would say is, well, what's the major contribution of Tanakh? Sorry?
Mosaic law.
So I would say, and we're going to talk about those ideas, I would say the number one thing is monotheism, right? Is the belief in one God. Even at the time of the destruction of the temple, before Christianity came around in the Common Era, most of the world were pagan. Jews were entirely unique in the fact that we believed in one God. And in fact, the Rambam says that it was a blessing that other people adopted the Bible as their own, because it was a way of spreading monotheism throughout the world. And in fact, it's been successful. It has spread to at least half of the world's population a firm belief in one God. And I think that's important, because before you had the belief in monotheism, what did people think the world was? They thought the world was random. Right, there was many different gods. There's the god of the wind, god of the rain, god of the sun, and they're all competing with each other. And my job is to pacify that god, and to pacify that god, and to pacify that god, with no absolute truth as far as what is right and what is wrong. Right? Each god had their own set of rules. But monotheism said, no, there's a creator before all of creation. And there is really one person, one being, ultimately, that is in control, and there ultimately is... There is a right way to live one's life, and there are wrong ways to live a person's life. And that's a powerful idea that has impacted the world, with a firm belief that there are true values, that there are values. And there may be debates over what those values are, but that there are values, that there are truths, there are proper ways for a person to live their life. I think another really important idea that comes out of the Bible is one of the things that come out from the story of creation, and that each person is created in the image of God. Right? That's an idea that was adopted by America, right? Very beautifully within our Declaration of Independence, but that all men are created equal, that each of us are invested with godliness, and that no person can say, I have greater value, I have greater inherent value than anybody else. But in fact, each of us have the same amount of value, and therefore each of us have the same rights. And that's an important idea that Tanakh, that the Jewish Bible brought to the world as well. Another important idea that we find throughout, one of the ideas in Tanakh, and this is an idea that has been championed by many different peoples throughout the millennia, and that's the ideas of liberation. The story of the Exodus from Egypt, which plays a prominent role within Tanakh and is referred to many, many times, that has really been the inspiration for many peoples when they have found themselves under the rule of somebody else. Certainly, most recently in American history, that of the African American community, that, right, let my people go, right? That this is a rallying cry for so many people in the world when they are oppressed, that they look to the Bible as inspiration to say that we have a right to be free. And in that way, the Bible has influenced movements across around the world for freedom. Another important idea that you find throughout Tanakh, and it's one of the ideas that we're going to find showing as you move into prophets, is the messages that the prophets bring to the people, that you can do all the rituals that you want, but if you're not moral people, if you're not good people, your rituals are meaningless. And that's an extraordinarily important idea that the Torah brings to the world of saying that you have to be a good person, right? That we have morals, that ultimately God will judge us according to the way we act, not simply by the rituals that we do. And that has had a great influence on the world of inspiring people to be better people, to be more moral individuals. And lastly, one of the great influences of Tanakh is that on art. Is that on art, on literature? I think very much so. I recently heard someone saying that all of the movies in Hollywood are really, you could break them down to 7 stories, and all of those 7 stories are found in the Bible. Right? That the Bible really is a source, is a way of influencing so much literature and so much of a way that we view ourselves, right? Ultimately, literature and art is a way of a person reflecting their values, and so many of those values are reflected through stories, through the inspiration that individuals take from the Bible as well. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit as well. And so in that way, really, this is perhaps the most influential book that has ever been produced. It has influenced the world. It has changed the world that we live in immeasurable ways, and continues to impact and influence the world that we live in. And that way, even more so, how great it is for us to have the chance to study it together this year. Okay. I wrote on the board over here, this is something we're going to sort of be talking about, it's something that we're going to see during the year. This course, this class that we're really doing now is sort of a little bit of a teaser, a little bit of an introduction to put the course into context. And so some of the ideas that we're talking about somewhat rapidly, and you're welcome to ask questions, but that we're talking about somewhat rapidly are going to be delved into in greater depth during the year. So one question that I asked over here is, what is Tanakh? What is Tanakh? Let's say somebody came to you from a place and they never heard of Tanakh before. They came from another planet and they said, what is this Tanakh? Right? What is this book that you have? Tell me about it. What is Tanakh? So I just want to go around. If people raise their hand or shout out, what would you say? What would you say Tanakh is? Okay. It's a breakup of book. But what is it? What tell me about what it is. So first let me just say that. I keep referring to Tanakh, and we're going to make reference to that in a bit. Tanakh stands for, it's an acronym for Torah, Nevi'im Ketuvim, Torah, the Bible, the Mosaic Law, Nevi'im, Prophets, and Ketuvim, Writings, right? It's all together. We're going to talk about exactly how that came to be, okay? And we're going to actually see that the reference to the Old Testament is not really a correct reference or a correct way of translating Tanakh. A more appropriate way would be either just Bible or maybe more specifically the Jewish Bible. Okay, so what is Tanakh? Yeah.
It's considered the written Torah, the translation of the written Torah as opposed to the oral.
Okay, fine. It's a written law. But what is it?
It's how the Jewish people understand their history.
It's Jewish history. Right? It's a book of Jewish history. What else? Yeah. Okay, so let's say it's a book of laws, right? It's a book of laws. It's a book of God, right? God plays a big role in this book. Okay, what else? What else is Tanakh? What do you tell them? What is Tanakh? So what do you tell them? What is it? What are the types of things do you find in Tanakh?
Narrative,
stories, right? It's a book of stories. In that way, it's very much influenced literature. Beforehand, if a person wrote, they wrote poetry or so on. Here, within Tanakh, you have stories, and that's very much so influenced. We see stuff up in front. Michelle, come around over this way. Yeah. It's a book of stories. There's lots of stories in it, and that's certainly influenced literature, Western literature, now for 1,000 years, 2,000 years, is that that's what we do nowadays. We write stories. What else? Yeah.
Can you say it's unedited stories?
Unedited stories. Okay, maybe. That's maybe more specific. Well, we can talk about that during the course. What else? What else do you find in this book?
Prophecies.
Okay, it's a book of prophecies. Okay, what else? Yeah. Morals, right? It's a book of morals and ethics. right? In addition to what we'd say maybe, let's say, ritual laws. Okay, what else? Okay, so what you say, it's not just Jewish history, but perhaps it's history in general. It has a story of creation in there. Right? That's not something just for Jews, that's for everyone. Okay. What else? Yeah.
The psychology of man.
Psychology, right? A lot of the stories are about what's going on in people's mind, right? It's not just this is what happened, but it's really an insight. Absolutely, psychology for sure. Okay. What else?
Family tree.
Family
tree.
Okay, it's about a family. That's for sure. Okay.
Temple service.
Okay, right. So maybe we'll put that under rituals, but let's say temple. What else? Yeah. Okay, it's about Israel.
It's also a way of contract between us and God.
Okay. That's good, I like that. What else? Someone says, what's this Bible? What's in it? What's it about? What other types of things do you find in it? Right, we talk about that there are stories in it, there's prophecies in it, there's morals in it. What else do you have in it?
Kind of a guide to how to lead your life on a daily basis.
Okay, right. It's a guide, right? Torah actually, right? That's almost what it means. What else do you have in here? What do you find sometimes people do in the stories? Something we do 3 times a day. Prayer, right? It's a book with prayers in it. Right? Book with prayer. I would say there's songs are in this book, right? It's a book with songs in it. Or poetry. What else? Anybody else? Yeah.
It's about the creation and maintenance of society.
Okay. Yeah. I think. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. That's good. Right. So let's write that on society. Yeah, in the back.
There are also warnings.
Warnings. Okay. Right. So maybe we'll say punishments. Book of philosophy, right? There's definitely philosophies in here as well. Right, we'll talk about some of those types of books, but certainly when we think of philosophy, what comes to mind? EO, right? The book of Job, right? That's definitely a book of philosophy, and it's interesting the way that's written. It's not written like a modern book of philosophy, right? It's written as a story, as a way of developing philosophy. Yeah.
Organizational structures.
Okay, interesting. Okay.
Government.
Fine. Excellent. So, that's great, right? Meaning, there's a lot of things in Tanakh, right? This is not a book which is one message, one idea, one subject. The Tanakh is full of so many different literary styles, so many different types of things in it, so many different types of ideas, so many different messages. It's meaningful to so many different types of people in so many different ways, so many different aspects of their lives. And so, this book of Tanakh, it contains a lot, right? Tanakh is not just some little book. It is very broad, and there's quite a lot contained within its pages, and those are the ideas. Those are some things we're going to be discovering throughout the course of this course. Okay, let's go on. I want you to take your, open your source packet now. One of the handouts you're going to get each week is going to be an outline, a general outline of that week's class, but open up to the following page, please. So here you have in front of you, this is the page, which is label number 1 on the bottom, which says the 24 books of Tanakh. 24 books of Tanakh. Everyone got that? Okay. So one of the things that you're going to notice is differences, or is uniqueness, meaning we list here how many books are listed here in the number column? 24. Right, 24. But if you look above, you may actually say, wait, there should be more than 24 books, because why? Look at Samuel, right? We know of Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet, but over here we only quoted it as one book, or Kings 1 and Kings 2. So that's on purpose. That's on purpose. The breakdown of the books of, let's say, Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet, that is not a Jewish spray down. That's what the Christians did as a way of making the book easier, perhaps, to handle. But according to our tradition, that's really one book. And in fact, when these books are, we're going to have multiple classes on some of these books, but it's not two classes on Shmuel because it's two books. It's going to be just because it's a very large book, and so it really requires two sessions in order to properly understand those works. Now, what I want to do is to flip in your packet and sort of keep this page, and I want you to look at where we have comparison between the Jewish and Christian canons. It's sort of a photocopy type of page. It's this page over here. After the pretty-looking pages, there's a page that says comparison between Jewish and Christian canons. So if you just look over here where it says Tanakh and Old Testament, one of the things that you're going to notice is, first of all, that the Christian canon has additional books. They're not in Tanakh. Those are books called Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha. Those are writings, and we'll talk about it a little bit more, why they're not included within our Tanakh in a bit. But they have more books. What I think is also important to recognize and to appreciate is that in addition to extra books they have, there's also different orders that they have with our books as well, right? For example, looking at where we start prophets. So how does it go? So we say Joshua, Judges, Samuel. What happens in the historical books in the Old Testament? What are they listed as? Joshua, Judges, Ruth. So what's going on? Ruth we have so much later, right? Ruth is part of our writings, of our ksuvim. It's not even in Nevi'im. It's not even in prophets. So why are they putting it all the way up there? Because that's when it happened. What are the first words of the book of Ruth? Vayhi bimei ha-shoftim. It was in the times of the judges. So they say, we're going to put it at the time when it took place. We're not going to put it in a different section. We're going to talk about why we have our breakdown the way that it is. But it's worthwhile to notice, and that's why I mentioned that when we translate Tanakh as the Jewish Bible, it's because it's not the Old Testament. It's definitely not the Old Testament. When Christians refer to the Old Testament, they're referring to a different order, and they're referring to additional books. It's very different than what we refer to when we refer to Tanakh. And if you continue down, you'll notice other books that they have here. I want to point out one thing which is interesting. What do we end all of our Tanakh with? What book? Chronicles, right? Divrei Hayamim. What do the Christians end their Bible with?
Malachi.
Malachi. So why do they end it with Malachi? Yeah, Esther? So where do we have Malachi? What's Malachi within our books? The end of Trails, right? The last of the books of the prophets. So I want to show you something which is pretty incredible. I'm going to read to you the last verses of Malachi, okay? And you tell me why you think it's last. These are the last words. Hine anochi sholeach lachem et Eliyahu hanavi. Behold, I will send to you Elijah the prophet. Vivnei bo yom Hashem, before the day of God, hagadol v'hanara, the great and awesome day. V'heshuv levavot al banim, and it will return the hearts of fathers to sons. V'lev banim al avatam, and the hearts of children to their fathers. Penavo v'ikit yad aretz becherb, lest I come and destroy the world by sword. So what is this a reference to, these final verses? It's referring to Messianic times. So they say, we're going to make that the final book at the end of the Old Testament, and then what's the New Testament going to begin with? With Jesus, right? And they say it's perfect. The final book of prophecy is going to talk about what's to come next, and then, lo and behold, look who came next, right? So they took the order out, they changed the order on, specifically to impress that message among Christians of the relationship between the prophecies of Tanakh and what they believe were prophecies about Jesus, right? That's not the way that we are at Tanakh, right? That's not our belief that, in fact, he was Messiah. But I don't need to go into that. However, that's worthwhile to notice the order that they put the books into because it is meaningful, it is important. Now, what you'll notice within the Old Testament, according to them, they break it down between historical books, the wisdom books, and then the book of prophets. Now, I want you to flip back now to our list. It's according to the way that the Jewish tradition breaks it down. Now, one of the things I want to mention before we go on is another important difference, and this is a very important difference, between the Jewish tradition and the Christian tradition about Tanakh. Now, when we open up a scroll in the Ark, so what do you find in that scroll? Letters, right? What don't you find?
Vowels.
There's no vowels and no punctuation. We're going to talk about that a little bit more later. What else don't you find?
Numbers.
No numbers. What do you mean numbers? What numbers?
Rocking.
Chapters. You don't find verses. Right? It just runs one into the other. There are certain breaks between certain verses that indicate it, but typically there are no breaks. So we believe, our tradition is that our tradition has it of where the verses begin and end. Right? That's based on a Jewish tradition that dates back to the times of Moshe, about exactly where each verse begins and ends. However, the chapter breakdowns that are found in every Chumash you're going to find in Me'ah She'arim, those are not Jewish. Those are not Jewish. Chapters have nothing to do with the Jewish tradition whatsoever. In fact, those are Christian, I would almost say, inventions that came hundreds of years into Christianity itself that they inserted into Tanakh in order to make it that much easier to quote chapter and verse, right? Make it that much easier to study it. Oftentimes within Jewish sources where it makes reference, so Rashi will say, oh, this is what it means, as it says, and he quotes the verse. And he assumes you know where that verse is, right? He'll say, oh, as it says in the book of whatever. He's not going to say in the 730th verse in Yechezkel, that's where this pasuk is found. That's not the way it is at all. There is no chapters according to the Jewish tradition. It's so helpful having chapters that we've inserted them into all of our books. But it is worthwhile to note, and it's important to know whenever studying Tanakh, that while it's helpful to maybe find where you're looking and to make sure they're all on the same page, not to take chapter breakdowns into consideration whatsoever when interpreting a story within the Torah, within Tanakh. And there's even a great example in our parsha this week of Noah. So if you take your chumashim, please, and open up to the very beginning of Noah. The second portion within the Torah, and I'll help you find it through chapter and verse, because that is the easiest way to find it, is open up to chapter 6, verse 9. And that's the beginning of the Parsha, the Torah reading that we're going to read this week of Noah. I don't have an edition in front of me to say the page number, so someone could just call it out.
30.
Page 30 within your Chumash. So how does our parsha begin? Of Eile toldot Noah, Noah ish tzadik tamim haya b'doratav. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was righteous. He was pure. He was whole in all of his ways. Very beautiful. However, where does chapter 6 begin? At the end of the book of Bereishit, at the end of the first section of the Torah. Why? What does it say over there? What does it say in chapter 6, verse 1? You got to flip back to the end of Bereishit, right? What's the very beginning of chapter 6? Vayhi Noach ben chamesh meot shana. That Noah was 500 years old. Vayola Noach, and Noach gave birth at Shem et Chav et Yafet, Shem Chav et Yafet. So the Christians logically said, let's start with the beginning of Noach's life. Let's talk about Noach and let's begin our chapters over there. It makes a lot of sense. However, that's not the way the Jewish tradition says that it should begin. The Jewish tradition says, no, it doesn't start with the birth of Noah. That's not significant to us. What is significant to us? The descriptions of who Noah was as a person. That's what's important to us. And that's always why it's important to also ignore the chapters, because the chapters are the Christian interpretation of what's important, of where a new idea begins. However, that's not the Jewish tradition as far as where a meaningful idea begins. And in fact, I think it's a very beautiful message, this, the fact that we specifically don't start with the birth of Noah, with his just having children, but most importantly, the most important way to start the book, the Parsha of Noah, is a description of the type of person that he was, the type of life, the type of relationship he had with God. And so that's why it's always important when studying, and you find this throughout the Torah, that perhaps where we begin in Aliyah will be in the middle of a chapter. Where we begin a parsha, we begin in the middle of a chapter. And to recognize that it's not just happens to be, but in fact that's meaningful. And always to sort of take note of, well, why is it that it starts in the middle of a chapter? Meaning, there's a very logical basis for the way that the Christian tradition breaks up the chapters. So if we haven't followed that breakdown within our tradition, the question is why? What is the significance? What is the meaning of it? And ultimately, being that our tradition dates back much beforehand, there is an important message usually contained within that breakdown, and that's always worthwhile to pay attention to. Any questions? Okay. Now,
are there many differences in the breakdown?
You know, all the time. All the time. Throughout the Torah reading, you'll notice that we do not begin Aliyot at the beginning of chapters. We do not finish Aliyot at the end of chapters. We do not begin. Sometimes we do, but other times it will begin a parsha, not the beginning of a chapter, and so on and so forth. And so it's really worthwhile to take note and to sort of try to ignore the chapters as much. And it's funny because in Jewish day schools, if a kid has homework, so what does the teacher tell him? He says, read chapter 3 and 4 tonight for homework. Right? We even have a Hebrew word for it. Most Jews will tell you, of course, prakimar, part of our tradition. We even have a Hebrew word for it. And so many in schools will say, oh, read Perek Dalet and Hay for homework. It's almost silly that we educate based on chapters. It's helpful, but it's not our tradition at all as far as how one is supposed to study, how one is supposed to understand the Torah. Okay, now looking back at this front sheet over here that has the breakdown of Tanakh, on the very far right side it says Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, right? That we have the Torah, we have the prophets, and we have the holy writings. Now one of the things we already pointed out is that the order of these books or the groupings of these books is certainly not based on their historical timeline, because the Book of Ruth is found in writings, and really took place at the time of Shoftim, which is in Prophets. And so the question becomes of what's the significance of this breakdown of Torah, of Nevi'im, of Ketuvim? And there's a number of different approaches as far as what this breakdown is really all about. So I think one of the most widely known and appreciated explanations is that of the Rambam, that of Maimonides. The Rambam says that each grouping reflects a different level of inspiration that each section of writings has. That when a person talks about Torah, those are books that were given to Moses directly from God. Word for word, God said this, and Moses wrote it down precisely as God had said, right? It's referred to in almost Kabbalistic ways of Aspa Klaria Hami'ira, right? This clear vision, crystal clear vision that Moses received. The Rambam then says that Nevi'im, prophets, that refers to a lower level of prophecy, what we would call Aspa Klaria She'ena Me'ira, sort of a vision that almost is through a veil. There's almost a veil, and you can see, but you can't see 100%, and that's what prophecies were. And Ketuvim, finally, those aren't quite prophecies, those are divinely inspired, what we call something that was said, the Ruach HaKodesh, right, with divine spirit. And that's the breakdown, that's the significance of why there's different sections to Tanakh. But there's other interesting explanations for where exactly Tanakh comes from. The chief rabbi of England, I mentioned we're going to have some English references in this course, he says very beautifully, he says, what's the difference between these different sections? So he says that in the Torah, God speaks to the people. In prophets, God speaks through the people, and in writings, the people speak to God. And it's worth all to sort of think about that breakdown, because it almost does somehow reflect what exactly is going on within these different sections. Again, the Torah is God speaking to the people, prophecy, the prophets is God speaking through the people, but Ketuvim is the people speaking to God. And I thought that was a very beautiful explanation as well. Okay. I want to just look at one other possibility of what this means. And this a professor, Schneer Lyman, shared with me. And this, if you turn to your pages, it's indicated here as page 5.5. I sort of added it. So here's it. This is a quote from Talmud Megillah. It says, types of prophecy on the top of the page. So this is here, the Talmud says as follows. It's talking about, quoting a verse from the book of Daniel, a great book. We're going to have a lot of fun studying that at the end of the year. It's really a really cool book. So the book of Daniel, it says, it starts with a quote of a verse. It says, "Vara'iti ani Daniel levadi et hamar'eh." That Daniel said, "I alone saw this vision. Vanashim asher hayu imi, and the people that were with me, lo ra'u et ha-mar'eh, but the other people that were with me did not see the vision, aval charada gedola nafla lehem vayivrachu b'hachava, but still a great awe fell upon the people, even though they didn't actually see the image itself. So the Talmud then asks, ma ninhu anashim, who were these people? Who were the people that were with Daniel? So Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah, Rabbi Yirmiyah said, v'itema Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, others said it was Chiya, the son of Abba, Zachagai Zachariah Umalahi. This was Chagai Zachariah Umalahi. Now these names should be familiar to you, because who are they? They're prophets. They're prophets. In fact, where are the books of Chagai Zachariah Umalahi found? If you look back on your list, they're found in Treyasar. By the way, Treyasar, minor prophets, which is the final book of Nevi'im, they're not minor because they're unimportant, they're minor because they're small books. Right? They're just small books. So they're important people, right? They are major prophets, just in little books. So the Gemara, the Talmud, is baffled. What's going on over here? How did Daniel? Daniel's found in writings. He's only found in Ketubin, and he saw the vision. Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, they didn't merit to see this prophecy, this image from God. So the Talmud says that inhu aditi minei, that they were greater than him, the ihu aditi minayu, and Daniel in certain aspects was greater than them. So let's say inhu aditi minei, they are greater than him, the inhu nevi'ei, because they were prophets, the ihu lav navi, and Daniel was not a prophet. Okay? Ihu aditi minayu, they were greater, he was greater than them, the ihu chazan, inhu lo chazan, because he saw it. And they didn't. So Rashi says, what does that mean? What does it mean that they were prophets and Daniel was not a prophet? What do you mean? He had prophecy. Of course he was a prophet. So what does it mean that they were prophets? So Rashi says, an important commentary, medieval commentary on the Talmud, he says, the inhu nevi'ei, that they were prophets, she'nitnavu li'Yisrael b'shlichuto shel makom. They prophesized to Israel as a messenger of God. But he was never sent to tell his prophecy to the people at any time. So what does that mean? It means they both had prophecy. All of these people had prophecy. They each had image from God. But who is called a Navi? Who makes it into Nevi'im? Specifically, prophets who received prophecy that they were obligated to tell the people. But prophets who received visions and then simply wrote them down, but were never told, go take this message to the people, that was put into a different order, a different grouping. And so it's not that one is greater, it's not that Nevi'im is greater than Ketuvim, or Ketuvim is greater than Nevi'im, they're simply different. All the books of Nevi'im contain somewhere in those books prophecies where the prophet was told, go tell this to the people. And in Ketuvim, you don't find any prophecies where the prophet was told, go tell this to the people. It has descriptions of prophecies. The books perhaps themselves are prophecies, but there is no directives of go tell this to the people. And so perhaps that's the breakdown between these different books. At the end of the day, though, and this is significant, is that there's many different books. If you look at the very end of your source sheets, there's a timeline in there that shows you the biblical period, that the Bible is not one book. It's not one book at all. In fact, the books of the Bible are written over a course of 1,000 years. They span a great time, and the Talmud in Bava Batra goes through who wrote all these different books. And each week, that's one of the things we're going to talk about, is who wrote the books. As an aside, it's one of the very beautiful things we're going to be doing in the course, is one of the nice things about studying all of Tanakh together as one unit, is that it's going to enable us to sort of take a similar approach to each book of Tanakh, and at the end of the year, give you almost a cohesive picture or a cohesive method of analysis for all the books of Tanakh. And one of the things we're going to look at is dating, is archaeology, and questions of authorship of exactly who wrote the book of Tanakh, in addition to developing major themes and ideas that each book presents, or important stories, or controversial issues. All those things we're going to look at for each book. One of the things we're going to look at is authorship, because they're written by many different books. Okay, Torah, that's written by Moses. But all the other books, different authors for each of them that span 1,000 years. But what's significant is, we call it Tanakh, is that it's ultimately all part of one book. It's all part of one idea. And that is extraordinarily important to our tradition, that we don't view them at the end of the day as separate books, but we view them all as one book. yes, certain books have more influential powers, but we view it all as one unit. And within Midrashim, within Midrashic tradition, that becomes very important, because when it comes to understanding a verse in Shemot, in the book of Exodus, they'll look at something that's found in the book of Daniel, written hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later as a way of influencing the way that we interpret a verse within the book of Exodus. And that, you would say, that's crazy. You shouldn't do that. Those are two different books written by different people at such different times. But if you say that they're all inspired by God, in some way or another, they're all inspired by God, then yes, it's just as legitimate to influence the way you read Shemot by looking at what you see in Daniel, then another verse in Shemot, what that might tell you about Shemot itself. And that becomes very important, that as we study Tanakh, and sort of as we get through to the end of the year, and we start referring to it, and we start seeing, and it's actually really cool, as you're studying Daniel, as you're studying Eo, you'll see something, and you'll say, oh, that's definitely why the rabbis interpreted that verse in Genesis, in Bereshit, that way, because they had read Daniel, and that told them that that's what it meant in Bereshit. And so, you really need to see the whole thing together, because that's one of the things we believe, is that they're not ultimately separate books. They ultimately all come from God, and therefore, each can shed light onto one another. That's also important, because that also impacts what we do with contradictions. There's many contradictions throughout Tanakh, and one might very easily say, different authors, different approaches. But if you say they all come from God, then you can't deal with contradictions, and you have to find a way to deal with those contradictions and to put things together. So that's what I want to just spend a couple minutes now to look at, to see one particular expression of the contradictions that we have within Tanakh. And for this, I'm actually going to ask you for a little bit of your help. So if you open up to 8 perspectives on God in Tanakh, that's on page number 4. The thing is, I apologize, they were going back and forth. So what I want to do is I want to read through these sources and then ask you, what does each source tell you about who God is? So I'm going to sort of break the room down into different groups. In each part of the room, if you could just take the next 4 minutes, turn to the person next to you, do a little bit of Chavruta study, of reading with the person next to you, and just talk about, you know, what does this portion tell me about what God is? So if everyone just look at me, this part of them could do source 1, source 2, source 3, source 4, and 5, and then 6, and 7, and 8. Just sort of take one of the sources and read it through, and then we'll get back together, and then we'll talk about what exactly the source says.
Are we 3 or 6?
3. Whatever you want. Probably something. Yeah, there should be sheets out. If we're in here, maybe we'll be out. Go 3 6. Yeah, go for it.
Can you do your points again?
1, 2, still in the back, 3. 4, 5, and then 6, 7, 8. You guys in the back can do 8. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, do 4 and 5. How God is described, or how you would describe God based on it. And now ask the person next to you what they think. Talk about it.
I'm
Okay. Let's get back together now. Can someone who read Source, I want to tell me what this Source is about and what it says to you about God?
It's a test of things.
What is Source number one about?
It's about God asking Abraham whether he has faith.
What's it about? It's a binding, right? What is it?
Oh, yeah.
Right, it's the binding of Isaac, right? Akeda Yitzchak. So if you were to say, who is God in that story? I don't know.
I'm omnipotent. Do you believe in me enough to do this?
Cruel. I don't know. I mean, right, it's a very difficult.
Unbelievable.
It's a very difficult story. It's a God who tests you in the most grueling and almost, you would say, cruel type of fact. Right? That's the picture you have of God. This is a God that demands that you do exactly what he says. Right, that's the vision and picture you have of God from that story. Two. What is source number two? What did that talk about? Anybody read two?
Provider.
Why? What's it talking about?
If I do this, God will give you this.
Right. It's Jacob. Right. It's Jacob. Jacob's making a deal. Right. He makes a deal with God. If I do this, and he, right, it sounds like a very human picture of God. Of a wheeler and dealer, right? Okay, let's make a deal, right? You don't mind back, I'll rub yours. Right, that's a picture you have of God from that source. Who read source number three? Yeah.
Well, I think it's source number three is when the Jews are crossing the Red Sea, and it's basically a statement of faith and praising him for saving them and killing the enemy.
So what is it? What's the word we use for God in this one? Do you notice there's a great word in there?
Savior.
Better than Savior.
Father.
Right? My Father is God, right? Meaning, it's almost like this relationship you have. It's almost this paternal picture of, right, he's, like you said, he's a Savior, he's coming, he's protecting you, right? A very, almost a valiant image of God. Source four. Yeah.
The protector. As the protector of the blind.
Right, he cares. He cares about the deaf. He cares about the blind. He's right. He says, "You shall revere me." I mean, God says, "I take this very seriously. I very much care about the downtrodden, those who have it difficult in life." Right? It's a very beautiful, a very compassionate image that you have of God. What's source five about? Sure.
The giver of the land, the one who fulfills promises.
Fulfills promises. Okay, excellent. Right? What else does it say? Right? This is also about war. Right? This is about a God who's going to take care of his people. Right? He's going to deliver. Source number six. Anybody read six? All right. What does it say? Come on. During the year, you'll get much less bashful.
It was like a parent-child relationship.
Why? Because it says, "I will be his father, and he shall be my son." Right? It's a very beautiful way of describing, right? It's talking about building a kingdom forever. Right? It's a very beautiful image that we have of our relationship with God. What does it say in source number? This is from Isaiah. Right here, how is God described? Right? These are very beautiful verses. Did anybody read 7? Right, so in 7, this is Isaiah, right, it talks about
teacher,
and God teaches us, God directs us, right, God tells us
inspiration,
right, so it's beautiful. And then ultimately in source number 8, how is God described? Who said that? As a husband, right, a lover, right, it's an incredible way of showing who God is. So you read Tanakh, and you're a little confused maybe. You know, which one is he? But that's what we all want to say. He's all of them, right? Meaning, if you want to understand God, you can't just look at one place in the Torah. You have to look at all of Tanakh together if you want to start to develop a picture of who God is, right? There's no listing up, right? This is who God is. Bum, 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 bum. You've got to study all of Tanakh to start to develop a picture of God. You have to study all Tanakhs to develop a picture of Judaism. And something that I found very meaningful, and because Tanakh really isn't studied so much in schools, it's something which is very much neglected, much more of a focus on Talmud study and so on, or Jewish law, is that it's really through the study of Tanakh that you start appreciating, oh, that's why the rabbis and the Talmud said that, or that's why it was that idea said over there. It comes from an inspiration of Tanakh, and Tanakh is where you find the values, the ideas, the messages, all of the ideals that ultimately influence the rabbis in their teachings and in their messages that they shared. And after studying Tanakh, all those ideas really come to life. And you really get to the heart, you get it to the core of what Judaism's soul is about. In addition to knowing Judaism's practice and its laws and so on, you get to the heart of really what Judaism, what the major messages really truly are. And so that's one of the great things about studying Tanakh and the importance of studying it all together as one book, because we really do view it all as one book, and you can only understand everything when it's studied all together. Okay, let's go on. I want to talk a little bit now about the canon, about how Tanakh came to be exactly how it is. Now, the Christians, we saw before their list of what they include within the Old Testament. They didn't decide that until the 14th century. Right? It was very late until they finally sat down and had a meeting and said, oh, okay, this is how it's going to be. Right? One of the famous councils that took place within the church. But that's when they decided this is exactly what should be in, this is what should be out, and that's why you even have differences between Protestants and Catholics and so on, as far as exactly what is and what is not included within the Old Testament. But when did we decide? How did it come to be of what's included in Tanakh, what's not? If you read some of the books that the Christians include in the Old Testament, the Book of Maccabees, the Book of Judith, the Book of Susanna, they're beautiful stories. They're beautiful stories. You say, wow, why aren't those part of Tanakh? Those are great stories. Some stories you can understand when you read them. I know why that's not part of Tanakh, because there's ideas in there that are clearly antithetical to Jewish values. But many of them, the Book of Maccabees is clearly written by a pious Jew about the story of Hanukkah. And I would encourage you, before Hanukkah, to read through the Book of Maccabees. It's a great book. And it's worthwhile historically, but we don't give it religious significance. And the question is why not? If these are such wonderful books, why didn't they make it in when other books did make it in? And so that's one of the questions that comes up. So I want to look at a source with you. If you turn to page number 6, please. This is a Mishnah that states as follows. And I'm going to skip down to the third paragraph where it says, all the Holy Scriptures. Page 6, third paragraph. All the Holy Scriptures. Tanakh renders the hands unclean. Thus the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, render the hands unclean. So what's going on here? What exactly is going on, right? What is hands unclean? It means tameh. If you touch a Tanakh, you become tameh. Seems crazy, right? It seems the opposite. What? Touching a Tanakh makes me tameh, makes me impure. The holiest thing that could possibly be is a Tanakh. How could it be that touching it will make me impure? So what's going on over here is fascinating. What else in the times of the Bible was considered tahor? Anyone? What was really tahor? Do we have any Kohanim in the room? What? Truma, right? The tithes that were given to the Kohen, those were considered kadosh. Those were considered tahor, holy. So what people used to do was they say, listen, my Torah scrolls are holy, are tahor, and this food is tahor. I'm going to keep them together. Now, what happens when you leave food out? Mice, right? Mice come to start to eat the food, and as the mice are eating the food, what else do they start to eat? They start eating your Tanakh. And so the rabbi said the only way for us to protect our holy writings is to say that anyone who touches them will become tameh. And then a person who needs to eat their holy food will no way keep it next to their food, because they don't want to become tameh, because then they can't eat their tahor, their holy truma. And so it's ironic, but a way of preserving the sanctity of our holy works was by rendering them that anyone who touched them would become tameh. So whenever the Talmud says anyone who touches them becomes tameh, that's a sign that they really think these books are holy. If your hands don't become tameh, then it means that they don't think these books are holy books. And so what you find is a description over what books are Tameh, what books are Tahor, tell us which books the Rabbis felt should be in and what books the Rabbis felt should be out. So as that first paragraph that we read saw, as they said, that Tanakh is obviously holy because it makes you unclean, as well as Shir Hashem and Ecclesiastes. But as it continues, that wasn't so clear. Rabbi Yehuda said the Song of Songs renders the hands unclean, but there is a dispute about Ecclesiastes, about Kohelet. Rabbi Yossi said Ecclesiastes renders the hands unclean. But there is a dispute about the Song of Songs. It's the opposite. No, everyone agrees that Ecclesiastes is in, but Song of Songs, that's not so clear. So Rabbi Shimon says the ruling about Ecclesiastes is one of the leniencies of Beit Shammai, one of the stringencies of Beis Hillel. What do they say? Rabbi Shimon ben Azai said, I have tradition from the 72 elders of the day when they appointed Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah head of the academy that the Song of Songs Ecclesiastes render the hands unclean. Now, why is there a dispute about Song of Songs? Why shouldn't it be holy? It's an erotic love story. I mean, you read it literally. It's a love story about a man and a woman. So some of the rabbis said, hey, not in this Beit Midrash, right? Meaning that shouldn't be part of our tradition. And they said, therefore, it's clean. And other rabbis said, no, it's very holy. In fact, as the next paragraph said, Rabbi Kiva said, God forbid. God forbid. No man in Israel disputed about the Song of Songs by saying that it does not render the hands unclean, for the whole world is not as worthy as the day on which the Song of Songs was given to Israel. For all the writings are holy, but the Song of Songs is the holy of the holies. He says that's the holiest of our books. So that if they had a dispute, they had disputed only about Ecclesiastes. And ultimately we know that Ecclesiastes also was considered to be in. And why would Ecclesiastes be a question? We just read it on Sukkot. It's very depressing. Who wants that to be part of your tradition, right? But that's part of our tradition also. And so that's something that you'll see as we study the books. It's always a question of, you know, what exactly is going on in this book. But what you see from these sources is that when do these rabbis live? These rabbis live into the Common Era, meaning they would decide, let's say by the 2nd century, exactly what books are in and what books are not. And that's really ultimately when it was decided what's in and what's out. What's worthwhile to note is that there were many books, the Book of Maccabees, that are written before the Common Era, written in the 2nd century before the Common Era. So it seems that what books are in, what books are out, are based on a couple of criteria. Number one, if the book goes against Judaism, obviously it's out. One of the famous books, the Book of Jubilees, clearly not Jewish, or not according to our interpretation of Judaism, and so that book is out. What it seems to be also is that our tradition says that the prophecy ends in the 3rd century, 4th century BCE. So any book that's written afterwards is maybe written by a pious person, is maybe a very special book, is maybe a very inspiring book, but it's not godly inspired. And therefore, for a book to even be considered, it has to be written by the time of the 4th century or during the 4th century BCE. If it's written afterwards, it's not even open to consideration. If it's written before, maybe yes, maybe no. Like the Book of Susanna, decided not, even though it's an earlier book. And so that's... perhaps ultimately how it came together, but the final decision was probably at a little bit of a later time, and it doesn't seem that there was necessarily a sitting down where the rabbis all got together and said, you know, let's make a decision, but it was a dispute. It was over time until it ultimately was sort of set in stone and said, this is in and this is out. And some say maybe that's the distinction between Nevi'im and Ketuvim, is that prophets was sort of established earlier, and the books in Ketuvim, those are books that were sort of up to question until a little bit of a later time. Yeah, in the back. Yes? You know, I guess it just becomes, meaning every tradition has to know what do you consider to be a value? What books do you look for inspiration? And I guess as books were written, it just became... So again, certain books, I guess, were clear. King David wrote it. Not necessarily, but meaning depending on how it was came together, so that became an issue, I guess, of identifying what was holy. It's unclear. We don't know the exact process. We don't know the exact. It happened a long time ago. Again, it could be that certain decisions were made by rabbis of earlier generations, but it seems like it wasn't a set decision where we got together like the Christians did, where there's sort of a meeting, but just over time, it just certain books just is accepted. Of course that's part of our tradition. But obviously that process is important because, like I said, we consider all the books to ultimately be part of one, and that's why that ultimate decision is very important for the way that we understand our tradition. Yeah.
Yeah. We include the book of Esther.
Yeah.
You know, Esther is, but in the
Right.
Why does one thing and the other not
So the book of Esther comes earlier. The book of Maccabees is written in the 2nd century BCE, after the time of prophecy.
So in other words, it's not a divine inspiration?
Right. I mean, it's a great book. It's a wonderful book. Read it. But it's, don't take your religious inspiration from it. It's not divinely inspired, even though it's written by a seemingly very pious person. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so it seems like people really... I mean, again, if you're going to be... at least certain people did. If you're referring to a verse in before you have chapters, people had to know what you were talking about. I mean, how would they know what you're referring to? So it seems like people did. And certainly within the Yemenite tradition, you go to an old Yemenite Jew, they can rally up all of Tanakh by heart. We're very much book-focused now, or maybe not even that anymore, that we don't really memorize things quite as much. But within the Sephardic tradition, you do find... greater emphasis on memorization of the Bible itself. But yeah, that's a good question. Fine, let's continue on. I want to just spend the last few moments talking to Diana, and I brought in a treat for the last few moments, as I think it's true. One of the questions that that needs to be addressed is, okay, we have this Tanakh, but how has it been preserved over the time? Meaning, how do we know that what we have in front of us is ultimately what was given to Moshe, what was told to him? And we mentioned that there is a tradition. There's no indications in the Bible where each verse begins or it ends. We have cantillation. We have vowelization and so on. It's how to read, how to sing the verses of the Bible. The question is, well, let's say that that comes from the time of Moses. That was the tradition that we've seen from Moshe. But how is that preserved? I mean, if it's not in Tanakh, how did it get down to us that, in fact, that's how it's supposed to be? So we're going to talk about the codexes. So certainly, at original times, perhaps, it was by word of. It was transferred from generation to generation. But what we find over time is that that began to be difficult. And you had families during the 7th through 9th, 10th century of the Common Era that took it upon themselves, it became a family tradition, to preserve what exactly should be in, how each pasuk should be written, how exactly everything should be written, what exactly the cantillations should be. And a lot of the markings we have for how one sings the Torah were developed. Again, not what the singing should be, but sort of the markings of how, that indicate it were developed during that time. And what's your name? As Andrea mentioned, right, that's part of codexes that were written during that time. One of the most famous is that of the Ben Asher family. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. But I wanted to sort of introduce you to the devices that were developed at that time for remembering it. So if you look at the last page of your handout, it's a photocopy of a page from this week's Parsha of Noah. Now, what you find over here is not really typically what most Mikro Gedolot look like if you open up. It's a version of Mikro Gedolot. There's really two printings that you find. This is the one that most of us are used to. This is what a typical page in the Mikro Gedolot, the version of the Chumash, that then has the commentaries around it. But what you have over here is a photocopy of another printing. You oftentimes find this in printings of the books of prophets and writings. You'll still have this older way of printing it. Here is a... sometimes it's printed like that for Chumash as well. So this is a copy of it that I took it from. And it's in fact extremely important. And it's really quite old. And it's interesting that it's not in... The markings I'm going to show you are only found in this printing, in this edition of Mikro Gedolot. It's not found in the more commonly found Mikro Gedolot that we find nowadays. So I just want to take a moment, take this off, to show you. And this is really... part of our tradition. What I have over here is a Chumash that was printed about 450 years ago in the city of Venice. This is printed in the year 1568, and in this edition, it is that old tradition. It is that old printing where you have. That picture that you saw from that photocopy. And what's special about this printing is the indications that you find on the page. If you look next to the boldface, the larger printing, there's little letters. There's little letters. And those letters are known as the Masoretah, are known as the tradition. Now, these are the letters, these indications are were the devices that were developed by the Ben Asher family in order, as a way of preserving the text of Tanakh. Now, what you'll find is, we'll just take one to look at, and another translation here, but if you look by the big Samech, before Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13. So over there, it's sort of in the middle of the page, it says, Vayomer Elokim Lenoach, that God said to Noah, Kates called Basar Balafanai, the end of people have come before me. Kimalah Aretz Hamas Minehem, because the world is full of Hamas, of destruction because of them. Vihinanima Shitam Adarz, and behold, I'm going to destroy the earth. So over the Vihinani, there's a little circle. So the little circle means look to your left. And what do you see to the left? A letter. What letter is that? A gimel. So that means that the word Vihinani, with those exact letters, not hinani, but vihinani, with those exact vowels below the words, written precisely in that way, appears in all of Tanakh three times. Three times, no more, no less. And so that becomes important, that if I'm printing a Tanakh, I've got to look through the whole thing, and I've got to make sure I have vihinani written exactly that way three times. If I have it two times, if I have it four times, I've made a mistake, and I've got to review my entire Tanakh to make sure that it's correct. Now, below in that printing, you have in little letters what's called the Masoreh Gedolah, the big Masoreh. And there it's explained a little more clearly what's going on. So if you look at the fourth line within those little lines over there, it's difficult to read, so I'll read it for you. Just one word in, it says Vihinani. Beginning of that fourth line, it says Vihinani Gimel. Three times Visiman and where exactly is this? And he quotes, Vihinani Mashkitam. First, as we just found in our verse, that's one place it's said. Where's the second place? Vihinani Amar Livnot Bayit. And behold, I said to build a house. And the last one, Vihinani Makeshet Eitzim, Mikosheshet Eitzim, that's the Mikoshesh Eitzim, the one who transgressed the Sabbath and collected the woods. That's the third place in all of Tanakh that Vihinani appears exactly like that. And so if I'm printing a Bible, I have to follow all of these notes, these indications, to make sure I've printed exactly correctly. And it's important because sometimes the notes will tell you when it's printed a little bit this way, or one vowel might be off, or there may be a slightly different vowelization, or sometimes the Masoreh is telling you not just that a word appears, but that the juxtaposition of two words together appears only four times. And then you have to make sure that those words together appear exactly those number of times. And so that was a way that, we've been able to preserve our tradition according to these devices that were developed. And they're amazing to study. A lot of mistakes have crept into them over the years in our print editions because the letters are so small, and probably because the printers, who are not necessarily scholars themselves, didn't know what they were looking at, saw above and printed a yud and didn't bother actually checking. That's why it's helpful to actually have old editions to see. The older back you go, you can see the more precise version of exactly what these notes in fact are. And it's interesting that over the years, after this time, in the Middle Ages, into the early modern period, you actually in fact have commentaries. I'm just going to take five more minutes. You in fact have commentaries who interpret these. And they say, well, why does it appear that way only three times? And they say, oh, it's because each of those verses is talking about such and such an idea, and that's why it's only found in those three places. And you have some very beautiful, some very interesting, witty interpretations of the Torah based on these, this Masoreh, based on this tradition of how to write the Bible. And so that's important to study. We're studying Tanakh to appreciate the labor that went into preserving the text we have is, in fact, the correct text. Now, I just want to take one more moment, just to share with you an interesting tidbit in history, because it's interesting to know that there is a tradition that the Ben Asher Chumash, or Tanakh, or the Maimonides writes that he used the Ben Asher edition of Tanakh when he wrote his laws about how to write a Sefer Torah. And so all the laws that the Rambam writes in his laws of Sefer Torah are based on the Ben Asher manuscript of Tanakh. The community in Aleppo, Syria, said that our codex, famously known as the Aleppo Codex, or known as the Keter Amtsarayim, that is the Ben Asher edition of the Rambam. Now, they didn't let anyone ever see this copy. Only the Chacham, only the leaders of the communities were permitted to go into a cave where they kept them and to go look at these editions. So in the middle of the past century, Professor Kasuto, who is a big professor at Hebrew University, a Bible scholar, is like, he's going to go to a Lago and find out what it says. And he goes with a bunch of questions and with a version of the Rambam in his pocket. And he says, there's something really unique within the Rambam. The Rambam writes that how many lines, there's a one of the songs within the Torah is that of Ha'azinu. Now, Ha'azinu was written as a poem. And the Rambam writes in Kasuto's Rambam, he writes that it should be 70 lines long. That's how long it is. The Rambam writes that in his laws. So he goes to the scholars of Aleppo and he says, I want you to go look at the Aleppo Codex. He's trying to figure out, is there a tradition, right? And he says, tell me, how many lines in your codex are there for Ha'azinu? They go in, they come out, and they say 68 lines. It's written in 68 lines. So he goes back to Israel and says, They're wrong. Their tradition is wrong. Later scholars went ahead and said, well, we've got to do something else. That before we go ahead and check the veracity of the Aleppo Codex, what do we have to check? The veracity of your edition of Maimonides. And in fact, in editions that have been found, you can now find them in Oxford or in the Jewish Theological Seminary, they found the original copies. You in fact can go there and see the handwriting and the signature of the Rambam. And they found that the Rambam in his real edition printed that Ha'azinu should be 68 lines. And you don't find anywhere else in the world any printing of the Chumash that 68 lines, except for in the Aleppo Codex that was in Syria. So in fact, it probably was the edition that the Rambam used to write his Mishneh Torah, and in fact, that's why these codexes are so valuable. Unfortunately, part of the codex has been lost in the riots that took place after the establishment of the State of Israel. It eventually was smuggled out. What we have today is basically Nevi'im and Ketuvim of the Aleppo Codex, but the most important part, the Chumash, is missing, though there are sort of rumors that different families in Deal and in Brooklyn may in fact have some of those pages. And in fact, there is a movement among certain scholarly circles trying to get those families that believe that their great luck and financial success has come because of their preservation of those texts, to at least allow people to see them as a way of reconstructing what, in fact, originally was in the Aleppo Codex. In any case, yes, you can go. You can see the Aleppo Codex there. Right. Again, you can't see that beginning part because they don't have it. But yes, you can go see it. It's in the scroll in the shrine of the book. You can see it there. In any case, we're on our own. We are going to be embarking on a journey over the course of this year, going through the source of our tradition, going through the study of Tanakh. And I very much look forward to studying together with you and the many teachers that will be studying with you over the course of the year. For those of you that have not registered, Ruth has kindly stayed a little bit longer in order to register any of you that are here. I can't encourage you more to take advantage. It's going to be a fabulous, fabulous year together. I'm going to take questions in just a moment. I just want to announce there's going to be a Maariv Minyan now for anybody that's interested. And in addition, another program that the shul is offering is Chavrutha Learning Opportunities. We have students from Yeshiva University that are here in Sir College. They're in fact next door right now. If anyone just wants to go to meet them, talk about possibly setting up a study partner, you're welcome to do so. They're next door. Just final questions, and then we're going
to...
Then I share during the early Middle Ages, 7th, 8th, 9th century of the Common Era. Great. Yes, Harriet.
I was talking to Harriet
Okay, so thank you so much for joining us tonight, and I look forward to seeing you in the next episode.